support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
So I sent you a message earlier that I wanted to do like a really egotistical show and just kind of like talk for a little bit.
Okay.
And talk about like, you know, the film festival that you went to, the film festival that I went to.
Sure.
And just kind of, you know, make it like this ego stroke fest.
Okay.
So, Rob, tell me about this Aspen Film Festival.
Are we doing it now?
Yeah, why not?
Is it just going to be an extra or something?
Yeah, something.
Do you want to do any lead-in or anything like that?
I think I already did. I said, Rob, I wanted to do this egotistical thing.
Okay, great. So Aspen Shorts Fest is in its, I think it's 22nd, 23rd year here in Aspen. And Aspen Film Society has two different things that they do. They do a shorts festival in the spring, and then they have a regular film festival, full features, in September. And the Shorts Festival ran for about 5 days last week, both here in Aspen and also in Carbondale, which is about 20 miles down the valley, down 82. And I didn't go to the Carbondale screenings, but I went to several of the screenings at the Wheeler Opera House, which is this beautiful opera house that dates from the 1890s here in Aspen, was completely restored. There's some really good stuff in there. The one that I was really taken with was one on Banco Lustvig, who is is one of the producers of Schindler's List. He won an Oscar for that. And and you can actually find this on the New York Times site. We should put a link up to it where people can see it. It's probably about 10 minutes long. And he was 13 when he was taken to Auschwitz. And with the liberation of Auschwitz after World War II, went back to his life and everything like that. And what it was he decided at this point, I think he was in his 80s, to go back to Auschwitz and have his bar mitzvah there, which he never got to have because he was in concentration camp. And it's pretty amazing story, not only his own story of his life, but also how he feels going back to this place, obviously, that was a scene of mass murder, and how he feels that this is a way to honor those who didn't make it. That one was really good. There was one called The Guide, which was sort of an interesting little film about, it's in sub-Saharan Africa, I think it's Mozambique. They have this national park, and there's a young boy probably in his teen years, ready to go to college, and his goal is to become a tour guide at this park. And how there are these different forces within the community and how the park has been used in various ways and how conservation efforts are taking place to try and, you know, save some of the animals from poaching and things like that. And then he also gets to meet several important biologists and various other people who come to try and, you know, save this place, which, to be honest, is the cradle of civilization. They talk about, like, you know, if it wasn't for this place, this park, then you really wouldn't have sort of an understanding of sort of where man and nature sort of coexisted thousands and thousands of years ago out of the migration out of Africa. So it's quite a beautiful film. The one that got a lot of attention, though, is a movie called Whiplash, which was it's probably about 20 minutes long and was produced by Jason Reitman of Juno and Thank You for Smoking and all of that, and stars J.K. Simmons. J.K. Simmons, of course, probably best known to folks as Jonah Jameson in the three Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies. And he's really good in it. It's a really great performance from him, but I really didn't enjoy it. I didn't understand why people liked it so much. The whole thing is basically there's sort of a college jazz band, and they're practicing this song called Whiplash, and J.K. Simmons is the band instructor. And it's almost like he's half Arlie Ermey, half like Kevin Spacey in Swimming with Sharks, where he singles people out and just yells at them and reams them out and does all this psychological like torture and mind games with them. And there's this new kid who comes in, and it's his first day there as a drummer, and he's sort of second string drummer, and he's trying to see if he can make the band. And basically the whole film just consists of this guy sweating, having a conversation out in the hall during a break with J.K. Simmons, and then J.K. Simmons is basically berating people for like 20 minutes. And while it's interesting to watch, I didn't get any larger point. It just seemed like it was like I can understand why J.K. Simmons wanted to do it. You know, it's like, I get to go in there, just, you know, yell at people. It's like, that's awesome. You know, so I can see that. But I don't really, I really didn't get sort of the larger point on that. But overall, I'd have to say Aspen Shorts Fest, a lot of fun. My friend Mike Fetner, who co-edited or actually edited my feature documentary a few years ago, good friend of mine, he had come here and had something in Aspen Shorts Fest probably 2006, 2007 maybe. And he told me, he goes, it's just great. He's just like, you know, it's really a great festival to go to. And the one thing that I really liked, and maybe, you know, like I said, I saw two sessions out of, I think, nine. I think there were nine sessions at the Opera House. And the one thing that I really liked about it, and this is nothing against Ann Arbor. I love the Ann Arbor Film Festival. When I was living in Detroit, I used to go. But Ann Arbor sometimes is a little too hip for the room, and it's not as enjoyable as it could be. And what I think Aspen does really well is put together a good program and a good mix where you're not bombarded with a lot of avant-garde stuff. And I love avant-garde stuff. I mean, we've talked about it before, you know, Kenneth Anger and Stan Brakhage and things like that. I mean, I just really like avant-garde stuff too, but I don't want to sit for 2 hours and just watch a bunch of avant-garde shorts. So that's why the Aspen Shorts Festival, I'm looking forward to next year. And I'm also looking forward to this fall to what they can bring in terms of a full film festival itself.
I'm still trying to get over the whole 20 miles away thing for the other venue.
Yeah, I mean, for those that don't understand sort of where I live now, Aspen is on 82, which is a road that runs from Glenwood Springs through this valley, and basically Aspen's sort of the end of the line. There's a couple of cities past there, but they're further out, and there's only about 20,000 people that live between Glenwood Springs and Aspen, and Glenwood Springs is 45 miles out, and so it's a rather small area in that way. So not a lot of stuff. There's little, like every 10, 15 miles is another town. It's a beautiful area. It was captured, of course, in Battlefield Earth, which we'll talk about soon. No, I'm just kidding. No, it actually was. There's a reference to it in Battlefield Earth. But it's really fascinating. Like, the one thing that I've learned coming here is that it is a small town. I've lived in a small town before when I first started in radio. I started in Bad Axe, which is in the Thumb. And it's sort of like Bad Axe in terms of small town feel, but with all of the celebrity people and Fortune 500 CEOs and various people that come here. I mean, the houses are million-dollar homes, multi-million-dollar homes. I mean, Jack Nicholson just sold a home here last month that is like a simple three-bedroom home that you would find in probably suburban Detroit for $11 million. The prices are just insane in terms of housing. And because you have these people who are used to using this place as sort of a second home, they bring all of this expectation of high culture from the coasts with them. So you have, you know, opera and ballet and film and art and all of these things in a town that, if you probably didn't have those kind of people here and funding it, it just wouldn't happen. The week before the film festival at the Wheeler, they showed Burn, which we talked about before on the Detropia episode. And it was introduced by native Detroiter, Robert Wagner. That's right. He was in the Pink Panther and an actor, and everybody knows who Robert Wagner is. So he lives in Aspen, and he's like, I'm proud to show this film. And when I grew up in Detroit, it wasn't like this. And it's really interesting where you have this mix of sort of art and culture from the coast, small town feel. And it's just a really interesting place. So if anyone's hip to come up to Aspen, you know, feel free and we'll have a drink.
So while you were doing that, I was doing the Kansas City Film Festival, which is over in Kansas City, Missouri, and I was asked to be one of the judges for that. I judged the narrative features and Heartland feature and documentary, full-length documentaries, feature-length documentaries, even though one of them was like 46 minutes, and I don't know. I don't know what the cutoff for features is when it comes to that. Interesting stuff. I actually enjoyed some of the movies that necessarily weren't in competition a little bit more than some of the ones that were. The three documentaries I saw, there was one called Narmada. A lot of it was shot on Super 8, and it was about this river that has kind of taken over a lot in India, and it relied a lot on some other stuff that had been shot before. One was kind of an educational short, and one was a documentary about protests that were happening in India, and I actually liked those bits more than I liked the rest of the movie, which was kind of sad. There was one called We Are Superman, which unfortunately I thought was going to be the sequel to Waiting for Superman. It wasn't. So, you know, don't get your hopes up that there's a sequel for that one out there. This was about a street in Kansas City where it's like really rich area on one side and really poor area on the other side, and just the kind of disparity of the rich and poor and just how this exemplifies it. And it was fairly heavy-handed, I have to say. And it was something, you know, coming from Detroit where it's just like, yeah, this kind of stuff happens all the time. I mean, you know, 8 Mile might have been that at one point, but, you know, there's other dividing lines in the city where it's just like, yeah, rich people are over here, poor people over here. You go from this block to that block and, yeah, you're going to see that kind of stuff. So whatever. Luckily, I kind of missed some of the hype for that since it was a Kansas City-based film. You know, there was a lot of like, you know, a bunch of people coming out for that. But luckily, I kind of avoided that. This one, luckily, the whole film festival took place in one place. It was all at the Alamo Drafthouse in Kansas City. And I didn't know before I went there that there were more than one Alamo Drafthouse. I thought there was one in Austin and that's it. But apparently they have taken over a bunch of different venues and kind of Alamo Drafthouse-tized things. And it was great. The seats were terrific. I love the whole idea of being able to order food and get drinks served to you while you're watching your movie. And it really isn't as disruptive as I thought it would be just because of the way that the seats are set up and everything. So that was kind of cool. And they had a restaurant there. So pretty much I would get over to the theater in the morning and not have to leave until, you know, midnight or whenever they kick me out. And so I just watch movies all the time. The third one that I watched for the documentary narratives was one called Uprising. And that was about the Arab Spring as it happened in Egypt. So that was the best one. And that ended up winning best feature-length documentary. Yeah, I don't want to go through film by film by film because I just saw way too many. I saw, you know, just a great selection of stuff. I have to say, though, a few things that stood out for me. There was a documentary called Bronies, and John DeLancey, a.k.a. Q from The Next Generation, was there, and the producer was there as well, and a ton of bronies were there.
You know, I got to ask you about this. Is it real, or is it just a joke? Like, are these people just putting us on when it comes to bronies?
You know, Rob, it feels like somebody somewhere was like, oh, dude, wouldn't it be very ironic if I were to like this show for little girls? Yeah, that would be, you know, and then they stroke their goatees or whatever. And it was like, it feels like it's this hipster joke that some nerd overheard and was like, oh, all the cool kids like this. I should start liking this too, because it feels like they're taking it seriously. But at the same time, like, they showed a bunch of clips from the show and stuff, and I was just like, I still don't see the appeal of this. Like, I can understand the appeal of, like, Dexter's Laboratory, the Powerpuff Girls, you know, freaking SpongeBob, you know, Jimmy Neutron, all these kind of shows, but I was just not seeing it when it came to My Little Pony, the animated show, and I was just like, this feels like, yeah, a joke that went awry someplace, and now all these people think it's cool. But yeah, it was just absolutely bizarre. It felt like something that really socially awkward people would get into, and all the people that came out for it were pretty socially awkward.
So they were just about a step higher up on the scale than us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've probably actually kissed a girl before.
Yeah, I've never done that. I don't even know which way it goes. Does it go horizontal or does it go vertical? I've no idea.
Well, it depends on if they're Asian or Caucasian.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yep. But yeah, it was absolutely bizarre and a little scary. And like, they actually took pains in the documentary to interview these psychologists who were like, oh, and we have done surveys of bronies and they are overwhelmingly heterosexual. And I was like, why did you have to point that out? And why do I still not believe you?
I don't want to question anyone's sexuality. I mean, it almost kind of seems like there was a documentary, I think it was called Nerdcore Rising, and it was about nerdcore rappers who are like rappers that rap about comic books and Star Wars, and they wear pocket protectors and tape on their glasses. And it's just about them, like, basically if, you know, Poindexter from Revenge of the Nerds decided that he wanted to be Tupac. That's basically what it's like. So to me, that almost seems like a put on, the way that bronies almost seem like a put on.
It totally feels like a put on, but I don't know. It just made me uncomfortable. It made me a little uncomfortable watching it, even though it is put together fairly well. I mean, they do a good job of, you know, picking out these people with their different kind of stories and following them and, you know, kind of building up as we go along and showing their introduction to culture and having this kind of narrator character that Delancey is voicing, this Professor Pony character, you know, kind of taking you through. But then there are a couple of things that they introduce in the documentary, like the girl who created the My Little Pony V4, as they say, because there have been three other cartoons before. The girl that created that, at one point she's like, yeah, and then I left the show and that was really bad. And I was like, okay, well, what's that all about? And I really want to know why she left the show. And it's like, they wouldn't talk about it. And I'm like, well, then why did you even put that in the documentary? That seems like the most interesting thing in this movie. And it was kind of like a throwaway line. So it was kind of weird.
I hate when movies do that.
There were two Q&As, one with Delancey and the producer, the second night of the festival. And then there was another Q&A that was supposed to happen with the creator of the show. Unfortunately, she was sick and couldn't come, so they ended up Skyping, and nobody asked her about that. So it's like, well, yeah, I want to know the answer. And I'm sure if I went out to Equestria Daily, I could find out, but I am not going to go any place where that stuff can be on my computer history. Thank you very much.
That really sleazy porn, no problem, but bronies, forget it.
Yeah, and that was the thing too, is that I kept wondering, like, was there ever a crossover between like furries and bronies? Because there are some costumes where I was just like, this really kind of reminds me of furry stuff. And furries, just, they're like, I don't know, they're like the Polish joke of the fetish community, you know?
You know what they would be called?
What's that?
Fronies.
Fronies, yes.
Yeah.
Now, I could understand if everyone who was into Black Dynamite was a frony. I think that would be freaking cool. So there was that. I have to say, the two other documentaries that people are probably going to hear about, well, one of them for sure is the Central Park 5, and that just played on PBS, at least in Detroit, like two nights ago. But I had seen it theatrically at this place, and that was an interesting documentary. It's one of these, like, hey, these kids, they got accused of doing something really awful, and they went to jail, and isn't that horrible? But then a lot of times it's like, well, don't forget that these kids weren't all like angels to begin with. So that they did a little bit of time is okay. That they did it for the wrong crime isn't. But were they total, you know, innocents that were in the wrong place at the wrong time? No, they were harassing people and causing violence and basically being a gang in Central Park. So I don't know. I hate being kind of a realist about this stuff, but whatever. And then the other one is called 20 Feet from Stardom, which is a documentary about, it is about background singers, really amazing interviews. They talked to, you know, Sting and Bruce Springsteen and Mick Jagger, and of course all of these background singers who are just so talented. And they did an amazing job kind of, you know, talking about, like, you know, how Phil Spector was just such a rapscallion that he would, you know, he had one background singer that he would take her and basically say, oh, and yeah, that's a new record by the Crystals, even though she's not in the Crystals. It was like taking her voice and selling it as something else and just being this, you know, complete jerk about everything and just this whole power play. And there were a few moments in the film that actually gave me shivers. There's one moment where they played the isolated vocal tracks from Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones, and they played, you know, the quote unquote background singer, even though she's completely in the foreground in that track. Oh my God, it was just amazing. I never really realized that, you know, when she jumps that octave, just how strong that is. Yeah, there were some amazing moments to this film. I have to say that probably the last 40 minutes of it, they really kind of lose this narrative thread that they've been following through the rest of the film, and it kind of becomes more like vignettes, and it really kind of falls apart. I think that it needs another maybe two passes through an editor, but I think it's done being edited, and that's really a shame because I think it could be a lot stronger than it is. There are some great parts to it, but really, after a while, it's just like, okay, you guys really need to put your thoughts together. It feels like, you know, just this kind of documentary diarrhea at the end. So those are two others that you'll be hearing about. And then there's one that people should hear about called My Father and the Man in Black, which is a documentary about the manager of Johnny Cash. Very, very well done. This whole thing is like all, well, it's not all found footage. There's stuff that's shot for it, but really you don't see any archival kind of stuff. And it is, it's just really, really well done. I have to recommend it completely.
Going back to the two you just talked about, I don't think people understand all of the things that they hear within a song. And there's a great documentary series that you can get on Netflix. I know that there's one looking at Deep Purple's Machine Head. There's also, it's several other albums. It's basically, they take like one album and they spend like an hour on it. And one of the things usually is the engineer is there and he'll fade certain things up and out, and it gives you a different perspective on what you're actually listening to. So I can understand what you mean, especially in that, you know, in Gimme Shelter, where you hear that, you know, you hear it in the mix, but it's like, if you had that isolated track, it's pretty amazing. I've heard similar things with Motown. If you take a tour on Motown in Detroit, the Motown Museum, they have certain things that they show you in terms of like how the tracks are built, and it's pretty amazing. The other thing with the Ken Burns, and Ken Burns is kind of hit or miss with me. It almost kind of seems like, do you think Ken Burns is trying to do sort of the Thin Blue Line here or something?
Yeah, that's what it kind of seemed like, though, you know, Thin Blue Line to me is one of these seminal documentaries that just really can't be beat. What I say that Central Park 5 did very, very well was they really captured what it was like in New York in the late 80s and all of the things that kind of fed into what the atmosphere was like, using a lot of archival footage. And talk about a divide between rich and poor. I mean, you know, the Wall Street was doing fantastic. This is, you know, the Patrick Bateman type era. And then you've got crime everywhere and, you know, just this really huge racial divide and stuff. The one thing, if I've mentioned this name to you, and I've mentioned this to several people, and nobody seems to remember what it is, I would like to see a documentary about the Tawana Brawley case. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, that was the case that really put Al Sharpton over back in, I think it was the early 90s, where this woman in, I want to say it was Brooklyn, said that she had been raped and got all this sympathy from the community, and they went out and they protested and fought on her behalf, and then it ended up being not true.
Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. It was a little bit earlier than that. It was like late 80s, because there's even a reference in Do the Right Thing where there's graffiti on the wall that says Tawana told the truth. And I think that will, and I know we'll talk more about, you know, our relationship with Spike Lee or non-relationship when we talk about Bamboozled in a few months. But that was one of the things that kind of put him on the wrong side of it for me, was just like, yeah, we really don't know yet if she told the truth or not. And this really seems kind of far-fetched. And then when it turned out all to be a lie, it was like, let's explore that story. I would really like to know more about that. And just the way that Sharpton was playing politics, seeing him in the Central Park Five documentary really reminded me of that, and really reminded me of my distaste for him.
He's hit or miss. I mean, depending on sort of where you're standing at any given moment.
He kind of is like the black Jeffrey Figer to me a lot of times. All in all, I have to say that the festival was pretty darn enjoyable. It was great. I actually managed to finally meet face-to-face Andy Rausch, who we had on the show a few months ago for Straight Time. Got to hang out with Skiz, and I saw part of his documentary again, Hit or Stay, which we'll be talking about in a few months with he and his co-director, Joe Torpea. So that was pretty great. And then, yeah, did a lot of editing. It was great to be doing editing on the Prime Cut show in Kansas City. I was trying to pick up the vibe a little bit from that one.
My plans include, because I'm out here, I'm hoping that come the fall, I might be able to get over to Telluride, which isn't too far away. It's in the same state. And then in January, of course, is Sundance, and that's just the next state over. So I'm hoping that I might be able to pull some press muscle and be able to hit up two of the really well-known film festivals here in the West.
Well, if you can't make it to Sundance, you definitely should check out Slam Dance, because they do a phenomenal job over there as well. And I actually kind of like them a little bit more, because they're kind of more, I don't know, it's more scrappy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as Hollywood as Sundance is to me.
I understand that. Also, got a little inside track. Do you know the reason why Troma Dance is called Troma Dance?
I imagine it was because something of Lloyd's couldn't get into one of the festivals, and so he was being vociferous and started his own thing.
Well, no, not really. Actually, I was there at the birth of Troma Dance, which is actually coming to Detroit, hopefully very soon. They started Troma Dance because in Cannes in 99, there was a slam dance party in Cannes, and Troma was one of the sponsors, but for some reason, they wouldn't let Lloyd in.
Well, if I was them, I wouldn't let Lloyd in either.
I mean, you should let your sponsors into your party, but anyway. So they did not let Lloyd in, and he threw a shit fit at the front gate there, and Lloyd just was like, well, forget these guys. I'm going to start my own festival. So, and that's how Troma Dance began. It can in 1999.
I've always been curious about some of the other dance festivals, if they're still around, because for a while it was like Scam Dance, Son of Sam Dance, all these different
Lap
dances
dance
that were going on over there. Yeah, I don't know if they're still around or if they've kind of given up the ghost.
I think that film festivals, it seems like they either go one of two ways now. They're either ultra local and very, very small, or they're like these massive things, like a Sundance or a Cannes or something like that. It seems that there are really not a lot of mid-range festivals anymore. And I think that part of it is, to be honest, it used to be that Sundance and things like that used to be the place that you went to sell your film. You would have your screenings there, you would get in there, and then there would be a bidding war between several distributors, and especially notoriously back in the 90s with Miramax. And that's how you got noticed. And it just doesn't seem like that's how it's done anymore. It seems more like you're finding a lot of ways, and we know this from our conversations with Will Keenan talking about Maker Studio, and how he's like, you know, the model's changed, and now people are working on leveraging video on demand and YouTube and things like that as a way to get their stuff out and make money. So, you know, the old channels of the independent theater and the independent, you know, distributor, or as you say, tied into the majors, really isn't the giggle it used to be. So maybe it's...
With the whole idea of theatrical distribution being so difficult and maybe not even that lucrative anymore. I mean, even to the point where it's like a lot of people are even rethinking releasing stuff on DVD because of streaming and because of, you know, iTunes and all these other channels that are out there. It's just like, should we even have a physical product? Should we show stuff in movie theaters? No, not really. Should we put them out on DVD? Not really. I mean, there's the whole bootleg question as far as that goes.
Yeah.
But then even then, it's, you know, you give someone a physical copy, it's very easy to make a digital copy of that right away.
You know, that's one of the things when on the opening of Misty Beethoven episode, you're going to hear that from Stephen Morawitz, where he talks about, look, you know, Misty Beethoven is this thing that you can probably get through a torrent site or you can get somewhere else for free. And it's like, but where's the market? The market is either in people wanting it for free or collectors geeks wanting to spend out and have something really, really nice to put on their shelf. So it almost seems that, and it's kind of that way also with theatrical film when you think about it. It's like they want you to spend all this money to go see something in 3D. So it's like, ooh, you'll pay $15 to see something in 3D, but you won't pay $7 to see something in first run normally. So just the idea that if we candy coat something, then you're more apt to buy it. It's almost like, I remember when I collected comics back in the 90s, and this was notorious in the early 90s, where Marvel and all these other places would put like these fancy covers, or they would do like four different covers for the same comic book. And it was like, well, why do that? Well, the thing is it would catch your eye. And plus, if you were a collector, you'd buy three copies. So it's like, you know, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah, the whole thing of, you know, we're going to release this one in a plastic bag or a foil bag. And, you know, so then you buy the one to keep in the bag forever. Then you buy the one that you can actually read if you want to. Just, yeah, such money grubbing stuff. And then the whole idea, too, of we're going to kill this character off. So then, you know, you'll buy the death of, and then you'll buy the resurrection episode as well. So just so stupid.
It's interesting, sort of like new models. I mean, like people were talking about something like Game of Thrones, you know, where they make something exclusively for Netflix, or this new season of Arrested Development that's going to come out. I guess there's also a werewolf, speaking of werewolves, from the Howling episode. There's a werewolf direct to Netflix that was just created by Eli Roth. So there's all of this, let's just make it direct to that. And it seems to be much more with TV than with film. But the question is sort of, you know, are theaters actually going to go away? Is that going to be the end of it? Is theatrical distribution not really even worth it? Because remember, when we worked in video stores, it was like, okay, the movie would come out, you'd see it in the theater, and then you had to wait like 8 months for it to come out on VHS. And then it came out at $100 a tape. And then it took another 6 months to a year for it to come down to $20 where you could buy it. So, the models have changed considerably even in the last 10 years and even more so in the last 5 years as things have become easier to stream online. And the question is how much do torrents, how much do bootlegs, things like that really kill any sort of ability to get stuff that you'd like?
We're going to be talking in a few weeks here. We're going to do two episodes, The Rep, where we're going to talk to Morgan White, no relation, about documentary on rep theaters. And then we're going to be doing the VHS extravaganza. And both of those are really kind of bringing to mind this whole thing. You know, one of the guys who was at the Kansas City Film Festival was the technical director, of the Alamo Draft House, and does some stuff with South by Southwest and all this. And just the whole idea of these digital cinema packages or whatever they are, basically it's the new format for projecting your movie through one of these digital projectors. He's talking about that and just the market for all this kind of stuff. And then 2 days later, I'm listening to maybe Studio 360 or something, and they're talking about this whole idea of you know, rep cinemas and going over from, you know, platters and projectors over to digital projection and just how cost prohibitive that is. And it's like, you know, yet another thing where it's like, okay, we're going to continue, quote unquote, upgrade our cinema experience. But at the same time, we're putting out of business the people who are doing the fringe stuff, which is really, to me, the most important stuff that's out there. I could give two shits about Oblivion, but seeing Suspiria in 35mm be still my beating heart.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, to me, it's always the independence, the underground, where ideas bubble up. So, I mean, they're always going to be 5 years ahead of anything that the majors are doing. And, you know, the one thing that's great about the time in which we live, and I'm really excited about a lot of the digital distribution of old stuff. I mean, we talk about something like a Warner Archives or MGM has that, you know, print on demand kind of thing. I think that's great. I mean, I'm really excited about the fact that distributors don't have to go, well, we need to sell 10,000 copies or more of this, otherwise it's not worth it to put it out. Instead, they can go, you know what, we'll just sell it, you know, one at a time. We'll just print them as people want them. And I think that's great. And, you know, that's one of the really great things about sort of the digital world in which we live in, whether it be books or it be music or it be movies, is that it really allows things that are out of print or have such a select, small, niche market to really get out there for people. Now, at the same time, and I don't want to be conspiratorial, is that the thing that really scares me is that as physical hard formats go away, be it books, be it DVDs, actual film, it's much easier to censor and to keep things away from people. Because as we had seen years ago with Kindle when it first started, Amazon recalled of all books in 1984 and just hit a button and removed it out of everyone's Kindle who had bought it. And that's the kind of thing that scares me, is that at least if you have a physical copy, you're always going to have it. And if everything just goes to ones and zeros and becomes a digital file, it's much easier to, you know, basically ban things or burn books digitally than it is to try and do it in the physical world. So we totally got off on tangents. We started talking about film festivals and then talked about our conspiracy theories on the state of digital media and media in general.
Let's talk a little bit more about us and just some of the stuff that we've got coming up. I mean, we've got shows programmed all the way out till August now. If folks are going to go over to the projection booth group over on Facebook, I think it's just facebook.com/projection booth or the projection booth, whatever. You can get to it through our website, projection-booth.com. You can go over there and you can get on our invites and see all the stuff that is going to be happening. You know, we set up invites every single week to let folks know what is coming on the show and if people can help out, if they have information or they just want to kind of, you know, talk about the movies before they come out. I mean, we've had some good discussions about stuff before they've come out, and then we've kind of used that for the show, which is great. Or, you know, people just saying, oh, you're doing a show about this. Have you thought about this? Like when we talked about Prime Cut, you know, last week, 2 weeks ago, and I think Rob Hubbard had said, hey, have you seen 99 and 44 100% Dead? And it was like, oh, this is kind of an interesting companion piece to Prime Cut that I've had forever, but I never sat down and watched. And that kind of made me watch it finally. So, you know, that was kind of nice. But so, yeah, folks can see that, and we've got just a great lineup. I mean, we're all over the map here. We're going to be doing, like, three, four weeks of smaller films. We're going to be doing some independent documentaries, like I mentioned before, with The Rep and Hit and Stay, and then we're going to do the VHS Extravaganza, which is hopefully looking at some of these documentaries about VHS. We've got at least three in the works, and so we'll be talking to hopefully the producers or directors of all three of those. And so that should be pretty fun. And then just, I mean, we're going to be talking about Death Race 2000 and Near Dark, Hackers, one of my favorite films. Oh, also, as far as independent documentaries, we've got Clean Flicks and I Am Divine coming up, too, which should be pretty darn fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been great, just the lineup. I'm really excited about all the various things that we're going to be talking about. And, you know, I'm really happy that, you know, we'll get an email maybe once, twice a week, message on projection-booth.com or even on Facebook. And people just going, you know, man, that was a great episode. Or we get a tweet and it was just like, oh man, you know, I really got to go back and reconsider this movie. Like, I think it was that with Starship Troopers. Like, people are like, yeah, Starship Troopers. And then let's do it. And they're like, I got to go back and see it again. And then they were like, oh, that was great. Yeah, it is much better than I remember. And that's the thing that's really exciting to me. I mean, I like doing the show and I'm proud to be a part of it. I mean, it's been about a year since I've been on with you. And I just love having fun and good conversation and having some great folks on and learning some stuff. And it's also been an honor to talk to some of the people that we've talked to. I mean, in the year that I've been on, I have to say high points for me have been, you know, Peter Bogdanovich and really Robert Downey Sr. I mean, huge Robert Downey Sr. fan. It was just wonderful to get a chance to talk to him and everybody in between. I mean, it's been so much fun. And I hope that people continue to, you know, give us some feedback and share it and have fun with it, because, you know, that's why we're doing it. We're not getting independently wealthy off this. Well, maybe,
yeah,
maybe someone is. But
maybe,
you know,
if they are, they should at least give us a cut.
Well, as a matter of fact, from the money that I've made from doing the projection booth, I can now afford to live in Aspen. So I bought Jack Nicholson's house for $11 million. So,
nice.
So, yeah, that's just from the projection booth. That's not even my day to day job. So thank you very much for downloading and enjoying, because I'm doing great. Me and my cats, we love it. It's a beautiful house. And Jack left a little present behind, an axe. So I'm hoping to give that a little whack from time to time out in the backyard, cut some trees down.
Speaking of, how's your book going?
The book's going well. Reentry, the Orbit magazine anthology. Wayne State University Press is going to put that out in about probably 2 years. And we're going to do a full archive of all of the magazines. White Noise, which is a Detroit sort of version of punk or slash magazine from the late 1970s. Fun Magazine, 86 to 90, which was sort of a, if you can imagine someone trying to do a free version of National Lampoon and putting it out once a month, and then Orbit from 90 to 99. Most people who are not from Detroit probably would know Orbit from Quentin Tarantino wearing the Orby t-shirt in his scenes in Pulp Fiction as a little nod to the fact, as we talked to Paul Zimmerman about on Reservoir Dogs. So you have to go listen to that to get all the info. But it's coming together really nice, and it's been working with the editors and getting them the stuff and doing all the scans and everything. So it's a lot of work. The one thing that's nice about living up here in the ski lodge is I only have my cats and I don't have a lot of people around to bother me. So it gives me plenty of time to get the work done. And also maybe I'm picking up on the vibes of the now sadly dead spiritual father of the area, Hunter S. Thompson. So hopefully his ashes will come my way and help me. But I hear that in the summer here, the bears come out, and that was the number one complaint of the Aspen Police Department. The number one calls that they got last year was not for crime. It was for bears.
They often call me a bear, so maybe I'll come out this summer.
There you go. See, you know, it's, I mean, I know you've been in hibernation watching all 8 of the Howling films. So, sorry.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. You should apologize for that.
Yeah. when I get to Detroit in August, I will take you out to dinner as an apology for having to watch all 8 of those.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah. The one I have to say that I'm really, well, 2 that I have to say that I'm really excited about as far as episodes go is the stuff that we'll be doing in a few weeks here about Scientology, where we're going to be doing Mock Up on Moo by Craig Baldwin, and we'll be talking to him. And that one is actually kind of, it's turned into another monster episode, because we're talking to Baldwin. We're talking to the guy who published the book Sex and Rockets, which was kind of an inspiration for Mock Up on Moo. And then we're going to be talking to the director of The Prophet, which was a film that has been banned by Scientology, if I'm reading correctly. And it is a very, I will say, close telling of L. Ron Hubbard's life. So that's kind of neat. And then the following week, we'll be doing Battlefield Earth and talking to the director and possibly one of the screenwriters for that. And, you know, I mean, it's been called the worst movie ever made. We'll see if that's true or not. I don't think it's, I've seen worse, you know?
Yeah.
I've definitely seen worse. I still say that Three Strikes is probably one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And if you haven't seen Three Strikes, should definitely look it up, because yeah, you might want to poke out your eyeballs by the end of the
1993, a law was created giving citizens three strikes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rob has left the building.
Rob has one more chance.
Screw up again, Rob, and that's your butt.
I'm gonna do whatever it takes not to go back to that place.
You gonna pick me up from jail in a stolen car? I got two strikes already.
What a dude.
We have late-breaking news on the Harbor Freeway shootout. One suspect was shot in the buttocks.
Do you need something?
Hell no, you can't give me nothing.
The second suspect still at large.
Where have you been?
Whoa, whoa, now I'm a grown man. I ain't got to be checking in with you.
You ain't gonna be putting your hands up.
This is the third time for you.
Get in, get in!
From the co-writer of Friday.
If you needed a checkup from the neck up.
Now why don't you give him a break?
I'm gonna give him a break. I'll break my foot off in the back.
And the producers of Dumb and Dumber.
Homeboy went crazy, man.
He went crazy?
He had a gun.
Two guns.
I should have known that you a lying little motherfucker.
Comes a new comedy.
I appreciate you sincerely for doing that little old time for your sahab.
The least I can do, you threw the damn gun in my lap.
That's on the loose.
Police have been over here looking for you.
I ain't do nothing.
Your face has been in the news.
Channel 2, Channel 7.
All right, hold your fire, man. Drop your weapons. Come out with your hands up and you will not be harmed.
Brian Hooks, Nabuche Wright, Faison Love, DeAndre Bonds, David Alan Greer, George Wallace, E-40, DJ Pooh, and introducing Monique.
The first thing we got to do is get some more donuts.
Three strikes.
That boy can run, can't he? Police can't catch him. That's my boy.
Running into theaters soon.
Well, you know, where those Scientology episodes, we'll talk more about this on those episodes. Where all that came from, dear listener, is that I read, and I recommend it to anyone. It's probably the best book I've read in the past, like, 2 years, is Going Clear. And it's a book by, I believe his name's Lawrence Wright, and he's a writer for, I think, The Atlantic. And he did this whole sort of deep dive on Scientology, basically L. Ron Hubbard from birth to death and in the whole thing since
and beyond.
Yeah. And it's just an amazing book. And I read it actually after I saw The Master. That's another thing we're going to talk about on that Mock Up on Moo episode, a little bit about Paul Thomas Anderson's film. And it's just an incredible book. And I didn't realize that L. Ron Hubbard had got in with Jack Parsons. And Jack Parsons was an American occultist, but a very important man in terms of rocket technology and the creation of the Jet Propulsion Lab and NASA and all that stuff. So it's just fascinating sort of how all of these webs sort of weave together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, it's truther than strange to, you know, read some of these stories and be like, wow, that really happened. And, you know, they were followers of Aleister Crowley. What the heck is going on? So yeah, we'll definitely talk all about that stuff. I think you and I, separate times, we're going to be on Outside the Cinema coming up here pretty soon. And I know you're excited. What are you doing? What, Hamburger the movie?
Are your parents encouraging you to get a college education?
Let me kill him!
Have we got a school for you? Forget Harvard. Forget Princeton. Learn to earn big bucks fast.
Beef plus buns equal bucks.
Come to Buster Burger University.
Fall in over here.
And see Hamburger, the motion picture.
We're here to learn to run a Buster Burger franchise.
A lot of bull in every bite.
A lot of bull in every bite.
But you'll get more than just an education at Buster Burger U.
Are you crazy?
You'll be stimulated by a student body that shares your interests.
Real neat.
You'll find a faculty that really cares about you. On-the-job training will get you ready.
Can I, Buster, help you?
For the fast-paced world of fast food.
All I ever wanted was to be a Buster Burger manager.
America, you're getting better, hungry. Hungry for the burger that makes you full. You're chopping for the taste of a Buster Burger. Our famous Buster Burger.
Thank you.
Buster Burger, America's favorite drive-thru restaurant. Hamburger, the motion picture. It's funny enough to eat.
I'm going to be on, and we're going to talk about, it looks like, definitely Hamburger, the motion picture, which is one of my guilty pleasure films, and possibly Aspen Extreme. We'll see. Aspen Extreme with Peter Berg from the early 90s actually almost sounds like a biopic of me. It's about two guys from Detroit who moved to Aspen to become ski instructors. Now, I don't know how to ski, but the fact that they moved from Detroit to Aspen is exactly what I did. So I guess maybe.
Are you going to take up skiing here pretty soon?
I'm going to wait till next season. I mean, the mountains just closed, which is funny because we just had like 3 feet of snow in the past 4 days.
Oh, geez.
And the mountains closed the weekend before. So there's only one mountain left open. And I'm not learning to ski right now. I'm far too busy doing this and writing and trying to take care of stuff at work. So there's a Detroiter here who you can follow on Twitter. He goes under the handle Aspen Spin, and he does a blog about Aspen, and Andy's a great guy. And he's like, you need to go skiing like now. I'm like, I can't. He's like, I ski every day. He's like, I skied 100 days this season. I go, congratulations, but I just don't have time. So I'm going to go next winter. So probably October, November, as soon as the snow starts, I'm going to get out there and get on the bunny hill, I guess. And then we'll just kind of see where it goes. And hopefully by the end of the season, I'll be doing Olympic ski jumping or something.
I'll tell you what to do. Go that way really fast. If something gets in your way, turn.
Me, I always looked like the agony of defeat guy when I tried to ski.
Well, there's that one Werner Herzog documentary about a ski jumper. I'm going to see if I can model my life after him.
There you go. Yeah, model your life after him, not after that idiot with the bear.
Yeah, the bear guy. No.
Yeah.
No. even though we have bears here, I do not want to be eaten. I don't want to be eaten by a bear.
No.
And I'm trying really hard not to be Klaus Kinski, so there you go.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered it.
All right, sir. Well, thank you for listening to this BS session between Mike and myself here on the Projection Booth, little something extra. As we always say, projection-booth.com. You can follow us on Twitter, ProBoothCast. And just keep sharing, keep telling, keep talking to us. Let us know what you'd like us to consider. We got a list that'll probably keep us busy till 2018, but we'll still consider your suggestions and see if we can fit them in.
Yeah, we are not ignoring people when they send us their suggestions. Just definitely have a list a mile long,
except in Canada where it's kilometers.
Yeah, it's like 2.2 kilometers long.
I was on tour in Canada with Miles Davis.
Yeah,
actually it's kilometers Davis. I'm sorry. I got to give credit to Zach Galifianakis for that one.
All right. Thanks for indulging me.
Well, that's what I'm about, selling indulgences. That's how I make a little extra money on the side.